all of that, and for various good reasons, including with respect to the licensing, as Ms. Mitchell mentioned, the exhaustion problem they have, they've dropped all of that. They've disavowed it, and they're quite clear in their disavowal in their reply brief at page 14, where they say those issues are not at issue for purposes, those actions are not at issue for this appeal. And so, you know, we don't respond to that. They're not at issue for the purpose of the bill. And they identify.
We appreciate that, but this is different, I think. I mean, this issue that they is somehow before us, at a minimum in gray and in the argument here, that's a different question.
Right, but I think that we have clarity in that they do, for purposes of this appeal, point to only one act, and they expressly disavow everything else. And they say, and this is a couple of places in their reply brief, but on page 11.
Two acts, I think. I mean, they may be related, but the licensing and the receipt of proceeds.
Correct, Your Honor.
Effectively, the ongoing relationship with a monetary incentive, et cetera, et cetera.
I think that's fair, Your Honor. So they allege two acts. They allege the agreements or the licenses with the individual growers, the plaintiffs here, and the USDA receipt of licensing revenue. As an initial matter, that's just not what their claim is in the case. I mean, that's not what their gripe is about, their claim of any unlawful conduct by the United States. But on top of that, those acts were never pled. They weren't in the complaint. They weren't in the First Amendment complaint. They weren't in the Second Amendment complaint. And indeed, the complaints are quite clear that what they allege is that the Table Grape Commission, not the USDA, entered into licenses with the individual growers. It was never argued in any way below through the multiple rounds of briefing, and it was raised for the first time in the reply brief, and it's for good reason. Because that act, let me refer to the two separate acts. First, the act of entering into license agreements with these individual growers. It was indisputably, and as the complaint makes clear, it was the Table Grape Commission and not the USDA that entered into those licenses. The USDA is not a party to those licenses. The Table Grape Commission did not enter into those licenses on behalf.
Collecting fees.
It's even a little bit more complicated. I hate to say, Your Honor, because
nothing in this case seems uncomplicated.
Yeah, I know, Your Honor. But what actually happened is the Table Grape Commission enters into a license with the USDA. Based on the license that the Table Grape Commission enters into with the USDA, it then enters into sub-license agreements with nurseries in California, charges the nurseries $5,000 for the right in general to participate in the program and then $1 per vine. Then the nurseries sell the vines to individual growers, the plaintiffs in this case. And as a condition of the receipt of the vine, the Table Grape Commission says, you know, we don't want any ambiguity about what you're going to do with this plant material when you get it, and enters into a separate agreement with the growers that says you agree not to propagate.
One and done.
Yeah, exactly. So with the payment here, Your Honor, is a payment that these individual growers are not making to the USDA by any means. If anything, they're making it to the nurseries.
But if the patent were declared invalid at the end of this road, which we may never go down,
right,
then the USDA is not going to have its patent anymore, and it's not going to be able to have licenses on which fees it is currently getting some fees, correct?
If the United States is joined to the case, right, and the patent, if the patents were declared invalid, then they could not charge. There would not be fees charged. Correct, Your Honor.
And so there would be an effect on the USDA, and they could no longer act as they have been acting in terms of licensing new patent and using, you know, their exclusive rights to inure some benefit.
But Your Honor, that would require this court ultimately then to hold that for purposes of the waiver of sovereign immunity in Section 702, which has to be, you know, obviously ambiguous and is narrowly construed, that the reference to a claim for an act means that where there is some sort of incidental effect that they suffered, that is sufficient to satisfy the claim.
The incidental effect that Delano suffered?
Yeah, I mean, Delano.
Well, they wouldn't, if the patent was invalid, it's not an incidental effect. Everything this is about, which is the extent to which they're having to pay license fees for the use of this product, would no longer apply. That doesn't seem to me like to be an incidental effect.
Well, let me put it this way. If, following the argument today, the USDA were to come to the Table Grape Commission and say, you know what, we hear the court on this. Table Grape Commission, you keep the license fees. Don't pay us anything that you owe us under the license agreement. Under this theory, there would no longer be an act. And it seems implausible that that is the type of act, then, that can actually be a claim of unlawful conduct by the United States of receiving the payment, when if, in fact, at the end of the day, the United States were saying, fine, we won't take the money from you from Table Grape Commission, everyone would be exactly where they are today. That there's just not the adequate nexus between a claim of unlawful action by the United States in simply accepting payments that run from the growers to the nurseries to the Table Grape Commission to the USDA, ultimately to say, yes, that the fact that USDA actually accepted that payment at the end of the day is an unlawful act, and that that's sufficient to constitute a waiver of sovereign immunity against a backdrop where waivers have to be clear and unambiguous.
I think we have your case, and we need to move on.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hadley, we promised you a little extra time if you need it.
I'll try
you
to
don't need
brief.
It.
Ultimately, what this case comes down to, even though there are some complexities involved, is whether our client has a remedy for the fact that invalid patents have been asserted against it, and it's been forced to license invalid patents. That's really what's at the bottom of this case. And I think that the answer to Judge Prost's question of the effect of Trudeau is that it settles the case. There's a waiver of sovereign immunity, and we can go forward if you follow Trudeau. Even if you don't follow Trudeau, I think that we still go forward because, as Judge Wanger recognized, there has been a final agency action. The acts that we point to are final. And at the appendix that Judge Schall cited, he said so. That was at page,
I think it was 126
to 128 of the appendix. He recognized that the licensing of these patents to the plaintiffs through the commission was a final act. And clearly, these were allegations that were raised and briefed and argued before the district court. They were not waived.
What is your response, Mr. Hadley, to the government's, Ms. Mitchell's argument about waiver and the second amended complaint on?
If I could just quickly run through the facts. The first original complaint, causes of action for declaratory relief of patent invalidity against the commission. Judge dismissed that with leave to amend. First amended complaint, the same causes of action for declaratory relief of invalidity and only this time against both the commission and the USDA. In addition, there was alleged a Bayh-Dole Act claim essentially under the Administrative Procedures Act. That was claim one in the first amended complaint.
Okay.
That is the claim that talked about some of the things that, you know, the pre-issue activity. That's not on appeal. Those were dismissed with prejudice. Now, before the court dismissed that with prejudice, if you look through the first amended complaint, throughout we talk about the domestic grower license agreement, the collection of royalties, the payment of royalties to the government, all of those acts. And they were all incorporated by reference into the claims for declaratory relief of patent invalidity. There's no doubt that those were in there. And as Judge Prost pointed out, the paragraph preceding, or the first couple of paragraphs of those causes of action, specifically said that they arose under the Patent Act.
Are you saying, Stan, that I want to make sure I understand that the paragraphs 78 through 80 of the First Amendment complaint at A521 are no longer pertinent?
No, they're, at page
521.
Of the First Amendment complaint, that's correct. Those are no longer, page 520 through 524 are no longer pertinent. What we are seeking are claims for declaratory relief of patent invalidity. That first cause of action, I would characterize that as dealing primarily with the pre-issuance activities.
But you said earlier that the action here is the licensing. Where is that fled?
Those are all of the factual background all the factual allegations that are incorporated by reference into the second cause of action, third cause of action, and so forth. Instead of repeating the entire history of the licensing and the domestic or license agreements and so forth, we use the well-accepted method of pleading to incorporate those allegations by reference and say that gives rise to a cause of action against the United States for declaratory relief of patent invalidity.
Now, how do those survive in the wake of the Second Amendment complaint?
Because the district court dismissed those claims, the second, third, and fourth causes of action,
right,
with prejudice from the First Amendment complaint, said that you have leave to replead essentially your first cause of action, your Bayh-Dole cause of action, to allege exhaustion of administrative remedies. But you can't replead the debt relief claims. Those are out of the case. So in our second amended complaint, we only pled the Bayh-Dole Act claims, and we really changed it to make the allegation of an exhaustion of administrative remedies, which the court ultimately rejected, and dismissed the Bayh-Dole Act claim with prejudice, which we are not appealing. But here's the...
You're saying you're appealing the dismissal of the second, third, and fourth claims for relief in the First Amendment complaint?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And the comments that were made to the district court about the claims arising under the APA that Mr. Moss pointed to, those were statements that were made in briefing the issue of the first cause of action, the Bayh-Dole Act claim, in the First Amendment complaint and in the Second Amendment complaint. Those statements, when we said that this case only arises under the APA, we were not referencing the already dismissed and out of the case causes of action for declaratory relief of patent invalidity. Those were already gone, and we were focusing on the Bayh-Dole Act claims in the first causes of action. So we never waived anything, and as Judge Prost pointed out, we specifically alleged that those causes of action arose under the Patent Act. Not that I think it would really matter, even if we said that those claims arose under the Administrative Procedures Act. We certainly never said that there was no waiver of sovereign immunity because they arise under the Administrative Procedures Act.
Jenny, we don't have the, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't see the notice of appeal here. Maybe I missed it in the appendix. But are you saying that the appendix makes all of this, that the notice of appeal makes all of this clear?
Yes. The issues that are set forth in the notice of appeal make this clear, that what we're appealing is whether the district court properly dismissed our claims for declaratory relief of patent invalidity.
In the First Amendment complaint.
In the First Amendment complaint and the associated claims for inequitable conduct and the antitrust claim and unfair competition claims. Just two other quick points, Your Honor. You cited, I believe it was the Justice Department memo on the scope of the waiver in Section 702.
It's the letter that now Justice Scalia wrote to the Senate committee back in 76.
And the case law completely conforms with that. Mr. Moss kept trying to characterize the Section 702 waiver as being narrow, but...
I don't know if that's a fair statement. Having written one of the cases that doesn't conform to that, I can sort of testify firsthand that I'm not sure you're right, that all the cases conform to that view. It may be that that's the right view, but it's certainly not the unanimous view.
I mean, what the cases do recognize is that the waiver applies, I would say broadly, when you have claims for non-monetary relief. I mean, that's really the linchpin, and there's policy reasons behind that. But going back to the language that talks about an unlawful action of an agency, what I think that means, it is clear, that means that you've got the agency as a proper defendant. And that is really what is required. To have a proper defendant, you have to have acted in some improper way, and the USDA here, as the patent owner, is the proper defendant to a claim for a declaratory relief action of patent invalidity. You can't bring an action for patent invalidity, duck relief action, without having a named defendant. And if the USDA or a government agency owns the patent, then they necessarily have acted in a way that makes them the proper defendant to that cause of action. And I don't think any more is required. There was one other point that I wanted to make, and that is that, I think that it was the waiver issue, and I've already addressed it, unless the court has any further questions.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Hadley. Ms. Mitchell.